You're listening to Trek FM.
There was a little bar in Mill Valley where all the Starfleet trainees used to go.
The 602 Club.
You know it.
I was there more times than I can remember.
Welcome everyone to Trek FM's local watering hole. I hope you guys are ready. We've got a great show for you. We're just here to talk some things geeky. Get yourself a great drink, pull up a chair, wherever you are, whether you're listening in the car, at work, in bed because you can't sleep, whatever. I've got some great friends here with me just to talk some Daredevil. We're going to talk Marvel's Daredevil, which just released not too long ago on Netflix. And with me tonight, Daniel, great to have you back. And I'm sorry, wait, is that Lex Luthor? I must have, folks, you can't see this, but this person doesn't have, well, yeah, he is quite bald like Lex Luthor.
Yes, actually, I'm here to buy some art. I would like just a white painting with some texture on it if you have it here.
It makes him feel lonely.
It does, yeah.
We're fresh out. This guy named Fisk just bought the last one. Sorry, man.
What can you do?
But my guess is, yeah, I mean, you could fight him for it, but...
I wouldn't recommend it.
I won't win. Yeah. That's okay.
Yeah.
You'll end up in pieces in the river.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
A lot of pieces over a week just dumped in the river, like Dexter. So, as you can tell, guys, we've got Andy back with us. Andy, it's so good to have you here on the 602 Club.
I'm glad that I don't have to fight about Iron Man this time with Daniel. I was a little worried we would start Civil War early last time, but we made it through, and now we can talk about a totally different superhero.
That is true. Well, you know, you guys are in luck, too. I mean, you Marvel fans, they moved Pan, the film, to the fall because they wanted it to have a more open space to breathe, basically, and not be kind of stuck in with the big summer blockbusters and just get lost. So... instead of doing that show that week, we're going to continue with the Marvel retrospective that we've been doing. We started with the Iron Man film, and we're going to do The Incredible Hulk. So bear with us for that.
Oh, come on.
I still say we skip it, but I keep
it's
getting overruled.
It's not that bad. Oh, all right.
Well, that's the thing, and that's the thing, is that I haven't seen the movie since it came out, and I want to give it a fair shake, and like we do here on the 602, I don't want to go into hating something for the sake of hating, and so I want to watch it with fresh eyes, and I'm hoping to be surprised. That's how I'm going in, so hopefully that's what will happen, but wanted to touch on something before we got started on the show. A lot of trailers got dropped last week. Apparently, it was trailer week because we got Star Wars, Batman versus Superman, Ant-Man has come out. We got the Fantastic Four trailer. It's like trailer mania. And so since we were doing a Marvel property, just kind of wanted to touch on the fact that last week it was Fantastic Four and just see what you guys were thinking about that, because this is a brand new take on the Fantastic Four franchise, which... is not a bad thing, especially with those first two films, for me. So what do you guys think of this new look, especially since we've finally got a look at the Thing?
No. we get a look at the naked Thing, because he's definitely not wearing shorts the entire time.
That is true. Although it makes... why would he wear shorts? Is there... this is a family show.
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. But you know, hey, in the new Marvel, in the Avengers and stuff, and the Incredible Hulk, he wears shorts still. So I don't know. I guess there's still a thing.
There's still a thing.
Well.
Wow. Can we name that the show? Yeah. There's still a thing.
Yeah. What's to say? You know. Meh. Okay, like I'll watch it for sure. Like the first two were dumb but inoffensive to me. You know, the Fantastic Four is just not my bag. It's just, to me, it's just kind of a, it, you know, kind of silly, kind of lame, kind of dopey.
Baby, not my bag. It's not my bag, baby, I swear.
I mean, I was excited in the trailer when I saw Kate Mara, because I have a bit of a crush on her from House of Cards.
Yeah, who doesn't?
But then of course she's the Invisible Woman, so you only get to see her half the time anyways. So it's like, okay.
That's true.
I'd say the casting is just about the only thing that was super, super exciting about this movie from the beginning for me.
Really? Like even the Reed Richards guy? Because I don't buy that for 1 second.
Well, Miles Teller did just get nominated for an Oscar, so at least we know he can act.
I don't know anything about his acting. I've never seen any him in anything, so.
Yeah, well, you would have seen him sitting at the Oscars almost winning an Oscar.
I suggest that you go watch The Spectacular Now, which may be one of the best movies of the last 10 years. I love that film. And then, of course, Whiplash, which is just fantastic. Both of those he's incredible in, and I mean incredible. And so, obviously, because he almost won an Oscar for his role in Whiplash. So the kid can act, and this is definitely the ultimate Fantastic Four, where they're younger and a little bit more vibrant. And so I kind of like that. You know, it again, the same thing that they're doing in the DC universe where they're differentiating themselves from what came before and doing something different, you know, you kind of need to do that, I think, with the Fantastic Four. And obviously as well, if it does well, it's a good film. It gives them the opportunity to have a long run of movies, hopefully, you know, 3 or 4, because these people can grow into their roles and continue to be them for quite a while.
Well, you don't get much more different in casting than Michael Chiklis versus Jamie Bell. So they definitely...
This is true, yeah.
They definitely changed it up a little. I'm really excited to see Michael B. Jordan as...
Johnny Storm.
The Human Torch. Yes, Johnny Storm. Because he's basically one of the awesomest actors on the planet, and I've been waiting for him to break out for a long time. He's deserved it since he was like 14 and being amazing on The Wire. So I'm just super excited to see him be in a big, awesome movie. And hopefully this movie is really good and then everyone will realize how awesome he is and put him in everything so I can watch it.
Now, am I mistaken? If I remember correctly, of course, you know, guys, we're all familiar that there's so much comic book movie news information going around at this point. So I could have been confused. But they're sticking this. This is now officially in universe with X-Men, right? They're putting them together in a shared thing there. Is that true? Am I remembering that correctly or not?
Daniel, there have been some rumblings that Fantastic Four and the X-Men will be in the same universe, and that they will be able to cross over somehow. And so there's definitely been those rumblings. There's nothing official, it doesn't look like, out there. But it's definitely something that we could see happening. And, you know, I think it would make sense. And so with all of that, but who knows? And I think it would be really great to see, especially if this Fantastic Four crew does well. I mean, the X-Men films obviously are doing well. You know, Days of Future Past, I was a huge fan of personally. And then, of course, First Class was excellent. And so... I'd like to, you know, hopefully see maybe something like that happen. Who knows? You know, not every team needs to team up together. That's just me personally. I think I don't know what to expect from this trailer, or I don't really have any expectations for the film. So I think I'm in a great place to actually like it when it comes out, and I'm trying to keep it that way. And so far what I've seen is that at least the story looks interesting. The effects look great. And, you know, hopefully putting all that together with, you know, some people that I do know can act, like Kate Mara from House of Cards and Jamie Bell and Miles Teller. And I mean, all these people can act. So that's fantastic. Hopefully they've just given us something great to do. So, here's to hoping that it is a great movie and it's really enjoyable. And, you know, it does seem to be the thing these days to take everything and make it a little bit more grounded and a little bit more, quote unquote, realistic.
Unless you're Guardians of the Galaxy, right?
Yeah, and I mean, how do you make that talking tree realistic? Right. You just don't.
It's totally realistic.
Yeah.
No, I mean, serious. It's totally realistic to think that aliens could have... evolved in a different way.
Oh, yeah, sure.
I think tree people make total sense, and I'm being completely serious.
Lord of the Rings fan over here, huh? All right.
Yeah, all right. Yeah, I'm okay with talking trees. I have no problems with them. So, yeah, I think this is great. I'm excited to see that. Well, as we jump into Daredevil, a lot of the questions have been, okay, when are we going to see Daredevil again? Just released today, as we were recording, they are already ordering season 2 of Daredevil, which is fantastic, and actually should be out sometime next year. So that's pretty fantastic, because this show has been very well received by people, and I'm not surprised, because I just remember it when it first got online on Netflix. Everybody was already asking, when are we going to get season 2? And well, we've got the answer now, folks, so everybody can just relax, rest easy, it's coming. What did you guys first think, just seeing this? You know, it's on Netflix now, it's a 13-episode, it's basically like a 13-hour movie, because all the episodes really play together. It's made for Netflix in the same way that House of Cards is made for Netflix. It's meant to be one long continuous story. It's meant to kind of be binged on. So first impressions of Daredevil as a series.
I started out not entirely impressed with it, which I could see right away from the reaction on Twitter, mostly, that I was alone in that, that everyone pretty much loved it right away. It was only about halfway through when I really started to get on board. The episode 8 episode called Shadows in the Glass, which is basically the first episode we get that's centered around Fisk instead of Matt Murdock. And that's when I was really like, oh, okay, they're telling me, they're teaching me something and telling a story that I haven't seen very much before. Because up until then, I really felt like it was basically Arrow, but with a less clear motivation for Matt Murdock. Because you walk into Arrow, and it may be silly, but they have given Oliver Queen a very specific goal and a very obvious reason for that goal. Whereas Matt Murdock is like, okay, so why is he fighting crime? He just likes punching people.
He does.
So in the last episode, you were kind of expecting Daredevil to approach Wilson Fisk and say, Wilson Fisk, you have failed this city.
I expected that from the first episode. I was like, why hasn't he told someone he's failed the city yet? Because, I mean, they do have very similar premises.
You have failed this city.
They do have very similar premises. You know, you have a person that has, like, put on a mask to go and, like, fight for their city, vigilante style. And it does have a darker tone than a lot of the Marvel stuff we've seen on TV so far. And it's shot totally differently. And it's just a different... It's a different TV show from the rest of the Marvel TV shows. It's like Arrow.
Is what you're saying. the thing is it's good. On the look of the show, you can tell this show has a lot of money to pour into itself. One, it's only 13 episodes long. But two, you can tell that Marvel is putting its money where its mouth is when it comes to these Netflix shows. And that they're shooting them in a style that is like and mimics a film and not TV.
Oh, it's gorgeous.
The production value
is stunning.
Yeah, it's beyond anything that we've seen on TV, and that's because they have more time and they have more money.
You know, and you know, not to get too far off the rails here, but one of the other things that really, like, not that this was an Arrow original idea, of course, but the flashbacks that we get very much were reminiscent to me of Arrow and how that whole thing worked out as well. And I've just got to say, like, man... you know, we're talking here about Netflix and Marvel, and it's like a Venn diagram of everything that works really well sometimes. I mean, you know, of course, Netflix has not had 100% success rate, neither has Marvel, but the fact that you put these two companies together, it was almost like it would be really hard for them to fail at this point. We throw this kind of money and these kind of talent at something like this. But, you know, my initial impressions were... you know, of course, when you're watching the first episode there, and more importantly in my mind is the second episode, which is really kind of where it kicks off and sets the real tone, I think. But it's just, you're right, it's nothing like Marvel has done before, that's for sure. And it's not like really, except for kind of how we're explaining here with the Arrow, but it's not very much like a lot of superhero television that we're getting nowadays either.
I think that's why it took me until episode 8 to really be on board. I mean, I liked it before that. I thought it was good. I thought it was entertaining. I thought it was well done. But it was episode 8 where they really fleshed out Fisk, and the reason that I, you know, having such a strong villain and a villain that had very clear motivation and has acted so well and, like, so engaging, that's when I was like, yeah, this is totally different than from what I've seen from a lot of other shows. And that's when I was like, okay, now I'm on board with everybody else. Let's cheer about Daredevil now.
I think I'm a little bit like you, Andy. It took me a while to, like, just figure out the show, like, to feel, okay, I kind of get this now. And I think part of it is that I've been watching Arrow for 3 years now. I've obviously been watching all of Flash this season. You know, I've seen how Gotham does things. You know, I'm used to how people do. I've been watching, and I still watch, even though it's still sitting on my DVR, and I forgot it was even there, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. but I've been watching all these things and how we do comic book shows on TV. And, of course, I was, you know, I'd say born and raised because I was too old at that point, but I was raised on comic book TV with Smallville as well. And so kind of know how you do superheroes on TV. And I think that's the real difference here, is that we're doing superheroes on Netflix as if we were doing them in a film and not on TV. It's a lot more epic. And this has the same, you know, kind of style as a House of Cards or kind of like a Mad Men. It's slower. It's plotting. It's building things. It's simmering slowly. It's like you're sitting in a crock pot. You're not, you know, on a flash fryer here. And you know, I'm been used to that, especially with Arrow and Flash, where things just pop. They just happen real quick. And that's just not how this show worked. This show is much more like it's an entire saga from episode 1 to episode 13, much like House of Cards is on Netflix. So, you know, it's funny for me, too, because I think I had a hard time with this show because some of the things about the villain are very reminiscent from some of the things in Arrow, especially season 2 with Sebastian Blood. In fact, Fisk's backstory is very much the same. He killed his father. He, you know, kind of hides away his mother from everyone. So there's a lot of similarities, and I'd be like, oh, I kind of already seen this. And he just wasn't clicking with me as an actor either. And I think that's what took me longer to get into that side. But on the other side, I love the guy. I love Charlie Cox playing Matt Murdock. And I really, really enjoyed Deborah Wall playing Karen Page. And so those are the two characters that kind of gripped me right away. And they kept me going. And the first impression wasn't the last impression for me. It didn't stay the same, which is always great for any show or film, is that it leaves you with a different impression once it's over. And I like it when that different impression is better.
Well, I mean, this is basically prestige drama comic book story. I mean, it's mm-hmm. the way it's told and the quality of the shooting, it looks like it belongs on HBO. So that's definitely a different like vibe. I just think it's interesting, Matthew, that we basically reacted the exact opposite, and that it took me a while to be on board with Matt Murdock and Karen Page because I thought they were the most boring part. And then that flipped a little bit as I got to know them better and they became more fleshed out as characters. Whereas Fisk, to me, right away made sense.
Yeah, and I think that's the great thing about this show, is that I do think that there's different ways for different types of people to be grabbed. And that's also what makes a, you know, just a good show or a good film, is that it can grab people in different ways and carry you along until maybe you pick up the other pieces.
I really like Fisk, but growing up in the 90s, I was, you know, my version of Kingpin is the 90s Spider-Man cartoon version of Kingpin, who is very, very not this version of Kingpin. He's extreme. I mean, of course, he's a giant man, and he's very assured of who he is, and he's very, very powerful from the start. That was the only version of Kingpin that I had been exposed to, really. I mean, of course, you know, I guess I'll be the first one to bring it up. In the Daredevil movie, we get Michael Clark Duncan, who is obviously a fantastic actor, but that movie leaves a bit to be desired. So you guys are like on the extremes, but I'm like right in the middle, where it's like I like half of what they do with Fisk, and then the half of it I'm like, okay. I mean, like I it is interesting and it's compelling, but there were times when I was like, okay, I wish you were doing something else.
I actually really agree with you, Daniel, because that character, even in the end, I feel like he's a very weak villain. Like, he comes off as weak. He's shown as kind of being weak, and just this basically kind of comes off as a little insecure fat boy still. And that's what he's portrayed as. And I'm not being derogatory. That's what he's portrayed as in the series as well. And he's still dealing with those issues. It's like, bro, grow a pair and just be a man and live, you know, because like he's all wishy-washy about what he's doing and whether or not he's really the villain. And my wife and I are sitting there when he's having that conversation about whether he's really the villain, whether or not all the things he's done makes him the bad guy. And we're like, yeah, it does. And any of your rationalizations for why you're not is just a lie to yourself. So
that was my biggest off-putting thing. Like, for whatever reasons, which they try to show, his insecurities just kind of don't mesh with that type of character for me. I understand that it might be more humanizing. It might be more, but this is a larger than life kind of character. This is like a. This is like Al Capone on steroids, right? That's what this is supposed to be. And you would not expect Al Capone to go through these kinds of
emo, whiny adolescence, baby,
almost
cry
immaturity,
sessions.
Like these kinds of issues. Like he would make mistakes still. That's fine. But like the fact that he's so unsure of himself at any point, I feel like in all of the episodes, he's like really just never knows where he is, and he's actually constantly having characters remind him of this. That's his whole arc, is like, you know, the woman who runs the cocaine ring, she's like constantly like, listen, you need to do something. You need to take care of things and fix all this. And he never gets to do it, I feel like. And if this is like long form, and maybe they'll bring him back in season two or season three or whatever, and like then he'll turn into that character, that's actually a really cool idea and a very interesting kind of backdrop. And then we get the really, but I was never intimidated really by Fisk, and I felt like that was the missing element of it.
So from mama's boy to badass is what you're saying?
Yeah, for sure, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, yeah.
I'm trying to think of a way I could disagree with both of you more, and it's not happening. I disagree so much. I mean, for me it was like this amazing character study of how someone comes to these decisions and why they make those decisions. And when he does, he keeps control of himself so much that when he does break down and like exhibit such violence, to me, it's terrifying. I'm sorry, I totally disagree. For me, that was the most important and interesting part of the show for me, is like unpeeling and unpacking this character and why he is the way he is and how he's relating to other people, and just this realization he has that that last scene where he's in FBI custody, and he just freaks out
that
and he's
cool.
Like, I am the ill intent.
Yes.
I mean, I had goosebumps all over. I was just like, oh my God, this guy is terrifying. And he has moments like that before. When he kills that Russian brother, I mean, seriously, his head became pulped. And that didn't scare you guys?
No, see, that's exactly, like, so I love the end scene when he's in that, like, when he's, like, realizing what he is. And that's why I said if there's more, maybe we'll get something better. But when he smashes this guy, you know, his head just explodes. It's like he's throwing a temper tantrum. And I'm like, why are you doing this? This is not helping you. He's literally shooting himself in the foot in that scene. And like, he's supposed to be this brilliant criminal mastermind. And he's letting this passion and anger get the best of him. And if that was the only time that it happened in the whole show, I would have no problem with it. Like, of course, maybe once in a while that you would kind of lose your mind about it, but it's like that's his constant reprogression of just like, okay, I get myself into a pickle, now I don't know what to do, I'm gonna spaz out, I'm gonna flip my table, I'm gonna do whatever I have to do. I liked the ending part because it was this calm realization of, no, now I know what I am, now I know exactly
I'm
where
the villain.
I am.
Well, but that was what it is. The whole thing is a character study of both Matt Murdock, sure, realizing, yeah, who he is, and Kingpin realizing who he is. The whole thing is an origin story told over 13 episodes, the difference being we usually only see the hero's origin story. In this case, we are seeing Kingpin's origin story at the same time. And that's why I thought it was so interesting. And the fact that they actually have very similar goals, but just totally different ways of approaching it and totally different experiences. And why does, you know, similar experiences send Matt Murdock down one road and this Fisk guy down another road? That's what I thought the whole point of the show was. Did I take that wrong?
No, I think you're right, Andy. I think the show, in some senses, is two men in a city. I mean, we were joking before, we could have named the show Two Men, a City, and a Pizza Place. But
more like CD Bar.
Yeah, CD Bar. There we go. But it is a juxtaposition of two men who love a city, and one who has no faith and who wishes to control everything, as if he's God, and another one who has faith and who wishes to save the city from this evil that he's seen going on at even the cost of his life, setting him up as the savior character, even though everybody kind of keeps calling him the devil of Hell's Kitchen, which is so funny because, you know, the biggest theme of this whole series is which one is the actual devil, you know, which one will actually play the devil and which one will be, you know, the savior. And obviously we know in the end, Daredevil turns out to be the savior, and Kingpin chooses finally to man up and be the villain. And I thought that that is a really interesting storyline. I just would have liked it better if I liked the actor playing Kingpin. I do not like him at all. I think he was completely off, and he never reaches the emotion that he does need when he needs it. Like, he doesn't have any range. Like, he's kind of one note the whole time, and he's either just kind of yelling or he's reserved, but there's no great in between that I feel like that character would really have, especially because I feel like he'd need to be somebody who's really good at hiding his emotions until he like blows up, to get where he's been. Like, and I don't think I just don't feel like that actor pulls off the role at all, and that's what really frustrated me. The actual storyline, like you're talking about, Andy, I think it is really interesting. It's the actor, for me, that doesn't pull it off, and that's what hurt the storyline.
And see, for me, I think it all hinged on Vincent D'Onofrio being amazing, so... This is one of the few moments I think we can point to, Matthew, in which we totally disagree. That doesn't happen very often.
That's okay. I mean, well, and that's what's great. Like, and I'm glad, though, that, you know, we're having the disagreement, because it's even in the end, I still like the show. You still like the show. We just have a great different opinion. And I think that there are going to be plenty of opinions about this show, because it doesn't have that easy grab, you know? We were talking about Arrow earlier. It doesn't have that easy grab, where you know exactly what you're going to get when you go in, and all of that. This is very complexly layered drama, and that is, again, different than a lot of the superhero shows that we've been getting on TV. Not necessarily films, because I personally think that that's what they're going for in Man of Steel, is more a complexly driven character type piece than just the fun romp. But yeah, that's what I think sets this apart in a lot of ways, is it is much more drama driven than it is like, well, we're just going to do a lot of cool special effects type stuff and a lot of fun comic booky things.
I like the actor. I've actually never seen him before in anything else. I know you
what?
Guys.
What?
I know.
Yes,
I know.
You have. Yes, you have. You just don't know it.
Yeah, you've seen him in Men in Black.
You've seen him in Men in
wait
Black.
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. Who is he in Men in Black?
He's the plays villain. Egger.
He plays Egger.
Are you kidding me? That just blows
same dude,
my mind.
The other thing that you've definitely seen him in is Full
Metal
Jacket.
I've never seen Full Metal Jacket, so.
What? My mind is currently blown.
But
okay.
I can quote you, Edgar from Men in Black. I'll take some sugar water. Anyways, sugar water.
I know Egger.
He must have.
And that wasn't
Egger. He must
have
like. Well, man, he blew up because that guy was relatively slim, right? And he's a bigger dude.
Well, he was a big guy. He just wasn't.
He's
that
been getting
large. Yeah,
bigger since he been on Law and Order and just.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe I guess
you sit around a lot on Law and Order. Okay.
Daniel, trust me when I say that you have seen this actor in many many things. You just didn't realize.
That's
it.
Funny.
He's
okay.
A chameleon.
So I think he's a good actor. And I think he, especially in this series, obviously not as Edgar in Men in Black, but in the series, he does have this physicality that I think Kingpin should have. Like, very intimidating dude. Like when he actually the scene we get when he fights Daredevil, not in the last episode, but before that, really good, really solid. You believe this man can crush this guy that has these super abilities, and you're like, I would not want to fight this dude. But like in most of his, he looks too vulnerable. He looks like he's apologizing all the time for like everything that's going on. I don't know what it is, if it's like his face, his eyebrows or what, but I'm like, I'm always like if I met you on the street, I wouldn't be intimidated by you. I mean, if I saw you smash some guy's head in a car door, then yeah, of course I'd be intimidated by you. But like he doesn't have that presence all the time. Like he has it sometimes, but he doesn't hold that presence constantly that I think is necessary for a character that's larger than life.
And see, I thought that was part of why I liked him so much, because he was this like silent threat throughout the city that nobody was realizing that he was even there until Matt Murdock steps up and basically pushes him into the light. He's just like this quiet, constant threat that has been slowly taking over New York.
I wanted to ask you guys something because I really do think this interesting. That this whole show has this kind of spiritual undertone to it, because Matt Murdock keeps visiting this this priest in the show, and it has probably been a very long time for me that I've seen a priest in the Catholic Church kind of portrayed in a positive light, and I really liked that here, that we were treating religion with some serious respect, and that these men of clergy have something wise to speak into our lives. And it was creating this whole spiritual undertone for what's happening in the city. You know, that there are a lot of different layers to what's going on. And of course, we are talking about the whole, you know, the devil aspect and all of this, and which one of them is going to be the devil. And I just, again, that's just a whole other layer to this show that I really, really liked. And it was kind of similar for me for Superman for Tomorrow, in Man of Steel, where he visits the priest as well. But in both of those places, the comic and then in the film, Superman visits a priest for advice as well. So I just liked it to see, and for me personally, faith portrayed positively. And I thought that just added a whole great layer, because it really helped us understand exactly what was keeping Murdock from wanting to cross the line of killing somebody. You know, it is his morality that's based firmly in something that a lot of people around the world can completely understand. And I just really liked that, because I thought that made that battle for Matt's soul much more compelling and realistic, because we really do understand, even if we're not somebody of faith, we probably know somebody who is, and can kind of see where that battle can come from.
Doing some reading after the fact, Matt Murdock's Catholicism is extremely important to him. And of course, as the driving factor of the show, we get exposed to a lot of it. But to me, it only comes across as important to him. To me, it never was a super integral part of what I was interested in. And of course, that's personal preference. But if we're talking about actors who don't necessarily gel, I didn't like the priest. I don't think he comes across as the kind of wise, kind of world-weary person that would have this sort of wisdom about him that we're expected to believe he is. So his scenes fall totally flat for me, especially his big scene when he's talking about going and dealing with these mercenaries and doing this missionary work. And I just felt like that scene was really long and really drawn out. And the story wasn't really effective for me. I don't really see why that, but of course, like I said, doing some research, what really motivates Matt Murdock and a lot of what he does is his guilt, and which kind of stems from his religious beliefs, which I can see is a very motivating factor for this guy. Like he feels he has a job to do, and then he knows he shouldn't. I mean, necessarily that's not the right thing to do, but sometimes you've just got to do what you've got to do, and that's kind of how he feels. But it wasn't, honestly, it was never in the forefront of my mind when I was watching the show, only because it impacts only one character, even though it is the title character. It wasn't ever anything that I really, really thought too much about.
I get to disagree with you again.
All right, yay!
Maybe we are going to start Civil War early.
I know, right?
I really enjoyed that actor, and I really enjoyed those scenes just because for so much of most of the first season, this is the only guy that Matt Murdock is confiding in any way. And the only way we get to see kind of what's going on underneath his stoic demeanor and like the pain he's in. So I actually really liked those scenes because they helped flesh out this guy for me, who I didn't have much of a sense of up until then. And so I enjoyed kind of seeing him wrestle with, you know, all these big existential questions and being able to talk it out with someone that he can trust, which is really helpful, especially since it's pretty far in before, you know, any of his friends, family, people he loves kind of come into the secret, which has always been, by the way, one of my least favorite things about superhero secret identities. I mean, how long is it going to go before Barry tells Iris he's the Flash?
Don't bring up Iris. Don't bring up Iris. She's not allowed to talk about ever.
And I mean, how long did it take before Thea Queen knew who Oliver was? This is ridiculous. It's just stupid. Yeah. And I'm really glad and I'm really hoping that Kara knows very quickly that Matt is Daredevil, because it doesn't make sense that he wouldn't tell them. And I just think it's cliched and done to death.
I will say that the one line that I loved from the priest was like when he finally decides, kind of like, yeah, I'm gonna tell you, and he's like, do you know what I do, right? And he's like, I'm not an idiot, Matt. Like, yeah. I can totally tell what you're doing. I love that. I thought that was great.
Well, I mean, to be fair, and this has always bothered me because this show is so grounded. Why would he wear an eyeless mask? Like, isn't that kind of giving away your whole game?
I always thought, I don't know. If I saw that,
just put some eyes in it.
I know, but somebody else said that too, and I always thought that, like, I don't know. You see somebody with like this, it almost looks kind of a sheerish material over their eyes. I would think you'd still be able to see through it. Maybe not excellently, but who knows? Like, I wouldn't. My immediate thought wouldn't go to, oh, this guy is blind and has super vision, super hearing, smelling powers.
See, but
that's absurd to think that that's what you would.
He has super smelling powers.
No, to me, like, this is okay. I mean, Superman, all he does is put on some glasses, right? That is probably our lowest bar.
Sure,
but this guy, his biggest.
He combs his hair. Yeah, he does a little curl and puts on the glasses.
No.
And acts unassuming, therefore people don't recognize him.
Oh, that's right. I totally forgot about the unassuming part.
You slump those shoulders a little bit.
No, but I mean, his biggest thing that he has going for him is the ableism of society. Nobody is going to think a blind guy could do any of this.
Exactly.
I know that.
Some guy kicks your ass in the alley and he's wearing a bandana. Is your first thought going to be like, wow, I just got my ass kicked by a blind dude?
If I saw him numerous times had no way to be seeing, and then there was also a super hot, jacked blind guy wandering around Hell's Kitchen talking about justice, then yeah, maybe I would figure that out.
Justice?
I'm sorry.
Let me tell you about justice.
Put some eye holes in it, no one will ever guess. I would like to point out that when they finally did the costume, they put eyes in it. I will let it go for now. But
Dumb guy, whatever his name was.
I like that. You know, you talk about the idea with the superhero secret identity, and you know, it is frustrating. I think for us as fans, it's frustrating for people in the actual properties for a lot of the shows that we see. But at the same time, there is a real, you know, danger for those people, and we see that play out a lot. I think there's a good reason for it. I think, you know, after 75 years of Superman and Batman, we've seen it a lot, and I guess we feel like we're beyond it. Except at the same time, if you're really dealing with the reality that you're a superhero and your, you know, family isn't, if people knew that you guys were related, you're gonna have an issue.
Look, I don't think that the three of us are like best friends, but I'll tell you right now, if I become a superhero, I'm gonna tell you.
Okay, because good.
I get why you would keep it secret from, say, your enemies. I don't understand why you would keep it secret from someone you pretending you love, because that to me is just patronizing, especially since so many of the time, the people that are not let in on the secret are women. And the reason they're not let in is because we have to protect them and they can never know. And that just has shades of just patronizing.
And I agree. Like, that's totally true. But what's absurd, like, no, I probably wouldn't tell you to. No offense, guys. But I would.
You better tell me.
Okay, maybe I would. But I would definitely tell the people that were literally interacting with me every day and interacting with my enemies every day. Like, these people that are in this situation where it's like, I don't know, Wilson Fisk already tried to kill her. Why would you not? It's like, it's a trope, and it's a tired trope, and it's a comic trope, and I just think we should leave it behind for the live action versions of these.
Well,
and
I always like it, and I especially liked the way that on the whole they've dealt with it in Arrow and Flash, and that they've organically worked into the story why people get told and how they get told, and I think that makes that part actually interesting. And that's what I loved about, again, Man of Steel, that she figures it out very quickly because she's freaking Lois Lane. She's a Pulitzer Prize winning, you know, journalist. Of course she's going to figure it out. She's not an idiot. And not having her figure it out made her an idiot for all those years. And so, there's a lot there that I agree with. And I think it is just kind of a comic book trope. And I feel like it can be done well and it cannot be done well. Here, on a whole, I felt like it was done relatively well because, you know, when Foggy finds out, he's not quite on board with it, you know, as some people might not be in your life. And I think that's the other reason heroes don't want to tell their secret, is because they don't necessarily want that kind of reaction either. They don't want to lose the people that they're closest to that way. So I think there's a lot more ramifications to it than some sort of like, we're just being chauvinistic because we're not telling the woman or the guys in our life. There's a lot of ramifications for it. But yeah.
I'm glad you mentioned Foggy, because I think my favorite episode is the Foggy episode, is when he finds out.
The flashbacks.
Yeah. Oh, I loved that episode. I thought it was great. Like, I love the character Foggy. Like, I feel like, man, that, like, he's just a dude that's got your back no matter what. And like, he's kind of got a heroism, like, underneath his, like, smarmy, snarky kind of attitude and stuff like that, but he really wants to do well for everybody that's in his life, and he really means well, I think, most of the time. And I think it's important for a character like Daredevil to have someone that's kind of real in his
life. I agree. That was a great episode because it really made us understand this unlikely friendship and exactly how deep it goes and why it works so well. And I think the chemistry of the actors works really well, and they are good foils for each other. And yeah, I really dig that friendship, and I really dig that flashback episode, and I really like that they had more than, you know, 5 minutes for him to deal with this and move on. It took him time to get over this, and it took him time to come to, you know, a peace with it, basically. And that was really helpful because it brought up a lot of extra characterization for both of them, and it was absolutely believable that you wouldn't go, oh, you're a superhero, cool, like, yeah. That's true. And I think Daredevil has done better than Arrow and The Flash, because I'm sorry, but Thea Queen is running the club above your superhero hideout. Maybe tell her.
Well, I'll answer it real quickly. I think when on Arrow, when it comes to Thea, Oliver doesn't necessarily always think clearly because it's his little sister, and therefore I think that's the main storyline that's been playing out for 3 seasons is Oliver trying to protect his sister as much as possible, and that's always been his motivation, is he loves her, he cares for her, he's trying to protect her, and it's he wants to try and create some semblance of like normalcy and life in her life because she's had so much death and everything else that surrounds her. So I completely actually understand, especially rewatching Arrow with my wife. We're in season 2 now, and I completely understand why he doesn't tell Thea. He wants her to have some kind of normal life. He wants that for his sister, what he didn't get. And with the storylines that happen, it's just not going to be possible. And I do love that she knows now, and that when she found out, that it was actually one of the most touching scenes I'd seen in the show. So it ended up paying off well. But that's a whole other show. We're going to talk about Arrow.
We should talk about Arrow again.
We're going to talk about Arrow. So, but I wanted to talk about here with Daredevil, the storytelling style, because to me, again, this being very different than anything else we've seen, it does. It feels like Mad Men meets House of Cards meets Arrow. And it is a dark, visceral, joyless, very realistic, very compelling show. Now, when I say all of that, none of that is a condemnation on this show. It's just kind of what it is. I feel like it is very much in the same vein as the Man of Steels and the Arrows and the things that DC is doing these days with those properties, as opposed to what Marvel has done so far. And I like it. I think it's great that we kind of have, you know, a more adult, more realistic, more thought-provoking take on these heroes. And I think Daredevil is a perfect place to do that, kind of like the way that Arrow has been for DC. And none of that's a condemnation, but man, this is visceral. I mean, we talked about that guy getting his head beat in, and there are some times when I think maybe the violence is just a little bit too much. Like, because it is. I mean, when somebody gets their arm snapped,
yeah.
You know, there are times when you see the bone go through. I mean, that is
or their dark. Their head beat in with a bowling ball, right? Like,
exactly.
We get a lot of head stew on this show.
Yes, we do. So there's a lot to unpack there, and there's actually a couple of separate issues. One thing, real quick, I wanted to mention specifically. This is when the series won me over, which was much earlier than the two of you, it sounds like. And I am not one, like, clearly you guys know from these conversations we've had tonight, I don't know anything about actors. Like, I don't, most of the time I'm just like, whatever. Right?
Clearly.
Right. But, so I don't really, I'm not like into movies as a craft so much as more, I just like, I'm interested in the stories. But I was struck by the season 2 fights, episode 2. I did that too.
Oh yeah.
The episode 2 fight scene. Where it was one take down the hallway and just falling through the doors and kicking, like, exhausted after being stabbed and just kicking the crap out of everybody. And, like, And it is a much more realistic take on violence in comics, especially as far as Marvel is concerned. Like, you know, mostly we get cartoon, you know, lasers shooting cartoon aliens, and that's okay. That's fun. That's what Marvel does, and it's good. But it's like, this is a guy. This is a dude. And he does have powers, but it's like, you stab the dude, he's going to bleed. That's what's going to happen. And he's going to get weak and tired. But it's very violent, and it's extremely kind of, like you said, visceral. I would say it's very, very far from a joyless experience. There's a lot of fun to be had here, in the context of the Daredevil world, for sure.
I have to agree with you about that fight scene, and I think that you are definitely not alone there. I've seen people on the internet just, like, weep with joy over that scene. I think it's amazing, and, you know, just as a heads up, I don't know if you guys are paying attention, but there was a bit of a controversy, and that we found out that Netflix doesn't do description for visually impaired people.
Oh, yes.
Which actually became a thing because, you know, blind people wanted to watch the blind superhero. Shocking. And it turns out that they didn't have the audio description for it. Well, Netflix, being cool, ended up doing it, and you need to listen to it. It is amazing. I thought it was just going to be like some guy being like, and now Matt Murdock walks down the hall and he punches a guy and then he punches another guy. But no, like whoever they hired to do the narration here, like, actually sets up the scene and like describes the colors and like the feel of the atmosphere. And it's amazing. And the section that I actually watched was that fight scene. And it was incredible. You should check it out. It's online in a handful of places, but you can also just flip it on your Netflix when you're watching it. And this fight scene is just so cool. I just love that he like has to lean against the wall and like pant every once in a while. And then he uses the momentum of him leaning against the wall to flip. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's really incredible.
Yeah, it's definitely, I mean, a well done show. And when I say joyless, I just mean like these characters very rarely have a good time in this whole series. There are a few interspersed places every once in a while where they're kind of hanging out at the bar and they're laughing, or they might be in the office and, you know, they're, but on a whole, it's not a criticism of the show because the storyline is dark. It is gritty. It is as visceral as it gets. It is as serious as it gets in comic book stories. And again, that's not a criticism. I think it's great. I think there's definitely a place for that. It's just there's very little levity. But it's not really a part of this part of the story. You can see the bits and pieces where it will become maybe part of Daredevil season 2, where there'll be a little bit more of it. But I think, you know, setting up this world and the story that they're telling here, it's just not necessarily a part of that story. And that is completely okay with me because, again, you know, and everybody knows it from the 602 Club, I love Man of Steel. It's not really a joyful movie. It's a serious movie about this character and his growth as that character. There's some moments of fun and joy in it that I really, really like. But it wasn't meant to be, you know, the Donner Superman. It's meant to be and start off in a more serious place. The same way I feel like this Daredevil is very much meant to start off in that. And that, again, it's completely okay with me. I like it. I think it's great. Only for me personally, and even my wife, we were watching it together. There were some times when the violence was a lot. I don't enjoy uber violent movies most of the time. And I don't enjoy watching them. So there were a few scenes where somebody's bone comes sticking out of their arm or things like that, that you're just like, oh, God, I don't need to see that. The rest of it, you know, like Matt Murdock being all beat up and then, you know, sewing him up, that stuff I completely know is fake. But when you're watching somebody get their head, you know, smashed in a car door and then there's blood pouring down and you kind of have seen the fact that blood spurts everywhere as the head's completely gone.
Head stew.
It's a lot. Yeah. So it is definitely, this is not for children.
I don't know. I mean, I hear you, and some of the violence does get pretty graphic, but I feel like they do it very specifically. So to me, it's not gratuitous. But I would actually say that even during some of their dark moments, there is an element of humor to a lot of it. I mean, I love the fact that Claire finds Matt dying in a dumpster. and just as like, oh, okay. And then they're like chemistry together. And then Foggy, every scene that Foggy's in is basically just delightful. And even when they're in the midst of some truly terrible stuff, especially Karen goes through the ringer here. I do think that they do find ways to you know, just put a little bit of humor in there. And maybe sometimes it's a little dark. But I truly enjoy that because I don't know that very many people can watch unrelieved darkness for very long. If you can't, you know, put a one-liner that's a little wry. Because I think Matt Murdock actually has a pretty great sense of humor, even though he barely laughs. I mean, he just is always doing that kind of wry smile and saying something that I think is super funny, even when he's, you know, in the midst of a fight scene. So I actually think it's a pretty funny show in a lot of ways.
So real quick, guys, I'm just curious because I actually really liked Charlie Cox a lot. Maybe Daredevil isn't my favorite character, but I think this guy did a really good job. And I bought him totally, like hook, line, and sinker from the start. As this blind dude, this blind lawyer, who's got this chip on his shoulder and he's just got something to prove. And we haven't really talked about it. We talked a ton about all these other characters, but I like him and I'm glad. I think it was really well cast as far as the lead goes anyways.
I agree. I think he, at first he was a little blank to me. But after a while I started to see more of what was going on under the surface and he kind of just brought it back, which I really enjoyed kind of like uncovering that character. And I just think he's got this quality to him that's it's very fun to watch. And I'm looking forward to seeing more of him and more of this show.
Just acting in general, let's kind of jump into that. What are some of the other characters that we haven't really mentioned yet? I mean, we barely talked about Rosario Dawson being in it. I really enjoyed the lady who is playing Wilson's love interest because she's Kal-El's mom in Man of Steel.
Oh, I didn't even realize that. Is that. Yeah. Oh, that's crazy.
You know, you well, have...
Well, we do know that you don't know actors.
That's true. That's
you've
true.
Made that abundantly clear.
You have Leland. You have, I thought, which... wouldn't it have been kind of awesome if James Wesley had actually been the bad guy?
Oh, don't get me started.
My wife and I were
thought
like,
that might happen. Like, yeah, there was my wife and I time were, where I was like, is he about to betray him? I feel like he is.
Yeah. We looked at each other and I said, I bet he's the bad guy. I bet he's been playing him this whole time and he's going to turn out to be the bad guy. And then he gets offed and I was like, what? What a waste of a character.
My jaw dropped in that scene. Like yes. Literally, and I'm like, no. Daredevil has been very smart, and every time Wilson Fisk gets cut or something, they show his little Under Armour, right? So I'm like, oh, no, this guy's got Under Armour. And then all of a sudden, it's like blood comes pouring out. And I'm like, you did not just kill this character. This character's amazing. Why would you do that? And I don't know if this is a comics character or not, but man, like... Just put, oh God, bring him back somehow. I don't care. Throw some sort
he
of.
He was great, but I think part of the reason why that death was so good is because he was great, and also because it put Karen on another level.
Yeah,
I mean, yeah, here's where we were like we're talking about what you thought was going to happen didn't happen. I thought that because earlier in that episode, Daredevil asks for his new armor. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was going to be your traditional comic book save the day. Daredevil was going to jump in there and it was his new armor and he was going to save her. But no, she saved herself and she did it in a believable way. He underestimated her. He put that gun down. She reacted at just the right time and she saved herself. And that was awesome.
It's an interesting scene too, right, though, because he wasn't at the time actually providing direct threat against her. It was this kind of manipulation, right, that we get from the bad guys of this series. I'm not that I'm saying like it's just it puts an extra layer, I think, on and then of course for the rest of the series now like Matt knows like something's wrong. Every time they interact after that, he's like, you've been kind of quiet. Like, what's going on? And she's like, oh no, things are just crazy, you know? But it's definitely changed her as a character. And I think that it's really interesting. It's really makes it like really.
Yeah. I mean, she shows herself to be violent.
Yeah.
She shows herself to be capable of killing someone. And she was supposed to be our damsel.
Right.
I mean, that's how they were setting her up throughout the whole series. And then suddenly, in a believable way, it's not like she suddenly turned into a cold-eyed killer. Like, in a believable way, we see her tested and we see what her decision was in that moment. And at this point, she makes a very conscious decision to kill where Matt Murdock has not. And I think that's really interesting.
Well, my wife and I, we talked about that scene. And this guy is threatening her life and everybody around her. And so I don't think that makes her in any way some kind of like cold-blooded killer. I think that it's self-defense, and
100%.
I have no problems with her killing that guy.
I don't have a problem with her killing him either. She should have. She did exactly what she needed to do in that situation to get out of there. What I'm saying is, there is like this decision that she makes to take another person's life, and whether that was justified or not, and I think it was totally justified. That is a huge decision for a character, and I think it really clearly shows a different side to her that we had not seen up to that point, and I thought it was really interesting.
Yeah, it makes her much more nuanced.
Interesting, right? If we're going to compare her character to basically Daredevil's entire decision arc of the entire 13 episodes. Should I kill this man because of the terrible things he could do, or should I not? And essentially, Wesley is basically telling her all of the terrible things he might do to her. Is not in any way directly threatening her life. Just saying, hey, listen, I could kill everybody you love, and I could then come after you and kill you too. It's actually
do what
really,
I want.
Right. Which is an interesting kind of. Like you had mentioned, it's a difference because Daredevil lands on one side of that and she lands on another side of it. And maybe, you know, season two, that's going to be a really interesting kind of conflict at that point.
I'm super excited to see it, to be honest.
Yeah.
I do think, though, that she is in more direct danger than he's...
Well, I mean, he puts the gun down.
Yeah, I mean, I think that he's... I don't think she's walking out of there. No matter what he says about killing everybody else, I just don't think she's going to walk out of there at all. I think he's just playing the whole thing, and if she doesn't cooperate, he's going to shoot her.
I'm with Matthew on that.
To me, that's how
she's in direct danger.
I don't read it that way one bit. Okay. Like this is a guy who works for the master manipulator. But I mean, yeah, that's fine. That's just my opinion. Like, I thought that.
That's okay.
It was very specifically in that scene laid out that. No, I dare you to leave this room. I dare you to leave this room and not do what I tell you and then see what happens. It's very specifically laid out. Like, I'm going to go after everybody you've ever loved and then I'm going to come after you. So you either do what I want or you don't. It's the choice is yours. You get to leave this room or you get to shoot me right now. And she chose to shoot him right now. And like...
I don't think he made the choice to say shoot me. He left the gun on the table.
He was.
But
like,
I don't think he ever thought she would pick it up.
Of course, he doesn't think he would. But he gave her the choice. There's no doubt about that.
I think that's the difference between her and Daredevil. Is nobody knows who he is. Everybody knows who she is and who she's close to, and so that's the big distinction. And again, that gets us back to why do you have a secret identity? Because you're protecting the people around you. This is why. They have these secret identities and they don't tell people who they are so that you can't, the goal is to not allow people to trace you back. And whether you do that well or whether you don't do that well, that has all to do with the script and how they write the character and all that stuff. But, you know, that's the big difference between Karen here and her decision and Daredevil and his decisions that he makes, because nobody knows who he is. James Wesley knows exactly who she is and who she's close to and her family and her friends. And yes, they will kill them indiscriminately. They could care less. So I think that's the big difference. And it makes her decision whether or not to kill very different than Matt Murdock's and whether he should kill, because the reaction of him killing somebody is going to be more the personal guilt that comes with it than it will be the reaction of, well, now they're going to go after Foggy, now they're going to go after Karen, now they're going to go after so-and-so.
You know that I don't want him to give his secret identity to the general public and his enemies, right? Just like,
hey, oh, no.
Iron Man did it. Iron Man did it. Come on now.
Actually, to be fair, Daniel, this is my favorite Iron Man moment. And it was when he's like, okay, I've got the story. No, you know what? Screw it. I'm Iron Man. Deal with it.
That
was great.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that, as we wrap it up here, that I think is really interesting about this show, and it plays into, I think, that more spiritual side of the entire show, which is, you know, there is a section of this series by the end where Murdoch doesn't really have to do a lot because the bad guys are already killing each other off. Some of that is from his action, but some of it's not. And I really thought it was interesting that the show was just kind of elaborating on how evil just kind of ends up consuming itself because you've created these web of lies and, you know, all these people just slowly start picking each other off because they think they're after each other, which they are. So I think that makes for just a really interesting theme on top of everything else we've had. And I think it proves out in a lot of the things that we watch, you know, evil, short-sighted, Lord of the Rings, it's only got one eye, you know, all these kind of places where evil it ends up destroying itself because of its own actions. And I thought that was a really cool thing to watch, is that really by the end of the show, it's not, Daredevil has a lot to do with people being brought down. But evil itself has a lot to do with itself being brought down.
Well, I mean, it's that whole thing where, you know, if you're evil, you can't trust other people. There's no true love there. There's no loyalty. That sort of thing. I do love, though, that you use Soren as, like, an actual literal eye. You said short-sighted. That might be my favorite thing you've ever done.
Yeah, thanks. Well, I mean, it kind of is, right?
No, I'm with you. I'm with you.
You
I
know, just, he doesn't. Like he really that. Doesn't. He's well,
from
he's
now on. I'm
focused.
Just
going to
describe Sauron as short-sighted all the time.
You know, I don't want to hijack the topic here, but one quick thing I wanted to mention is that now, like after Iron Man came out, we got Captain America, the First Avenger. Well, Daredevil is our first defender, right? And we're going to have 4 Netflix shows, which actually I'm really excited about all of these other Netflix shows. That, you know,
I cannot wait for Jessica Jones.
Jessica Jones.
I cannot wait for Jessica Jones.
Luke Cage is going to be great. And then eventually...
Iron Fist.
And then they're going to do a Defender show. And of course, this is literally years in the future. But the rumor is that maybe they'll pop up in Avengers 3 at some
in like
point.
An Infinity Wars.
Yeah.
I think that is really cool. You know, I'm not sold on the girl playing Jessica Jones. Hopefully she'll win me over. But hey, I liked it. Let's get to the final thoughts. Ratings for Daredevil. For you guys, what would you, you know, kind of rate this series? Andy?
9 out of 10.
I like it.
Basically,
short, simple,
almost
easy to
perfect,
remember.
Just a handful of flaws. And other than that, completely sold on it. Can't wait to see more.
Yeah, maybe 8.5 or 8, 8.5. It's close. It's great. It's awesome. It's totally worth watching. It does have some issues, but what show doesn't? And coming out of the gate, man, you know, most season 2s are better than season 1s. And if it's the case here, we definitely have a treat to look forward to, I think, for sure.
I think for me, this show is... a very well done. It's a solid show. I think for me, it's a 7, 7.5 out of 10. It's because of some of the issues I had. I don't like the villain. I don't, in the sense of I don't like who's playing him, and that really weakened that part of the show for me. Every time he's on screen, I just wasn't buying what he was doing. And if I don't like the protagonist, the main like juxtaposition to my hero, it's really going to bother me with the rest of the show. Luckily, this show is so strong in the other areas that it makes up for it in a lot of ways. And so I have to really give them credit for that. to be able to overcome that. It took me a while to warm up to Foggy too, personally. I just did. But he won me over in the end, and I liked everything else about the show, except for, and I will warn you guys, the listeners, the show is violent. It's very violent. And if that's not something that you like, this is going to be in there. It's rated MA for mature audiences only on Netflix. And it's definitely for only mature audiences. There is no nudity, but there is cursing in here. There's a lot of violence, and it's pretty graphic. So other than that, though, I think this is a great show. It's a solid show. I would still, and I can say this now because I'm rewatching Arrow, and I would still choose Arrow over this, and that's just because Arrow's more fun in the end. I have more fun watching Arrow than I do this. But that has, again, that's not a criticism of this show. I like the serious nature of it. I like the visceral nature of it. I think it's fantastic. It's well done. And it's needed. We need different types of comic book heroes, different types of comic book series to keep things fresh. And I think they're really doing that with Daredevil. And I'm glad to say that I finally like a Marvel show.
You liked Agent Carter.
I did like Agent Carter, but we still had our issues there. And I think this is their first real home run. This is a solid home run. There's no argument about it. So I'm really glad to be able to say, if you've got Netflix, you should go watch this show. If you don't have Netflix, go join for a month for free, watch the show, and then you don't ever have to, you know, be a part of Netflix again. So
Netflix is now bigger than CBS, which is
that
absurd.
Is true. I mean, it's not surprising. Yeah. So
it's awesome because Netflix gives their creators like basic freedom,
total freedom, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I think that, and that's a great, that's a whole conversation, but I think you can see the creative freedom that they have here. They're not constrained by much, except for maybe what Marvel kind of wanted from them. But they have total creative freedom because they can do it as violent as they want. They can have curse words if they want. They could have nudity if they wanted. So they're not constrained any by that stuff. But they're also storytelling-wise. They're trying to tell a good story with good characters. And I think any of the superhero shows that I have liked, and like Flash and Arrow specifically, it's because they're just telling really great stories and they don't feel constrained creatively. They are just running wild with story and it's awesome. So when you do that, I think it really pays off. And I think it's paid off in spades here with Daredevil.
Well, one of the things that they did is they brought some really powerhouse creators in. You've got a lot of people on the directing, producing, writing side of this show that are just infamous. I mean, Stephen S. DeKnight, Doug Petrie, and Drew Goddard are all Buffy alums, so they've been doing like this kind of superhero storytelling for a long time. And
so you're telling me Marvel at this point is just, it's a good old boys club for Joss.
To be honest, I honestly think that Joss Whedon has been influencing a lot of things.
I'm sure.
I know you don't know actors, but Kobe Smulders, who plays Maria Hill, got that part because of Allison Hannigan and her friendship with Joss Whedon.
Oh my God, I just made the connection that Allison Hannigan was...
Yes.
That's right. Okay. Sorry.
Yeah. So I actually think you joke, but I think that that's probably a big reason because, look, they got Jed Whedon and Marissa Tosheron to do Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., and they got a bunch of people who did Buffy, and Drew Goddard wrote with Joss Whedon with Cabin in the Woods, and they got them to do Daredevil.
Would Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. be better if it was on Netflix?
I think so.
I think Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. would be better if it was just a better written story.
Okay.
I think it's just plain and simple as that. I think you can do... It has nothing to do with whether it's on Netflix or it's on, you know, a television network. Because, again, Arrow and Flash are killing it. They sure are.
Yeah.
There is no better comic book show on TV, and I mean actual TV right now, than The Flash.
I agree.
And so they are showing that you can do legitimate comic book on TV and do it fantastically, and it's because they're telling it with great story. I mean, there's no two bones about it. So,
I mean, I absolutely agree that the writing is the main problem with Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., but the CW and ABC are totally different networks. And ABC, right out the gate, wanted a Monster of the Week format for that show. And that was the first, 10, 12 episodes of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. was really boring stories where they went to collect some superhero.
That's when I quit, and I haven't watched
exactly.
And
that's a very network-driven decision. So I agree totally that I doubt that Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. would be like 1 million times better, totally different story if it was on Netflix. But I do think they would have had a little more freedom to play with their format.
Well, and there you go. I mean, studios, let your creatives be creative and create great shows.
Wouldn't it be lovely if network executives would just, you know, pay the bills and go away? We didn't even get to talk about my favorite character, which was Claire Temple. We need more time. You need a 2-hour 602.
Yeah, Claire, you know, just quickly, I feel like she's an underserved character.
I agree with you, which made me sad because I wanted to see more of her, and I really love Rosario Dawson.
Oh, I do too. She's fantastic.
Did you really just look it up, Daniel?
I didn't remember her character's name. So as soon as you said Rosario Dawson, I was like, yeah, I do actually know that one. I know that one. So
yeah. Yeah, well, you should.
She's
great, and they had great chemistry.
They did.
It's just disappointing that she got very little to do. Hopefully that will be fixed in season two.
Although I will say that as much as I wanted to see her more, I did really like the fact that, and this is, again, something that, you know, you are expecting it and it didn't happen, is that she totally was like, look, I really like you. But, you're not honest with me, and you're super dangerous, and I can't be with you because of that. And then she left, and I was like, good for you. I mean, if all of the comic book love interest did that, none of our superheroes would have girlfriends.
I'll be around
or boyfriends if they were, you know, girl heroes. I mean, so it goes
both
ways.
Yeah, but they don't have that same type of dynamic usually.
Oh, look who's being sexist now.
No, I'm saying.
We'll find out when Supergirl comes out, won't we?
Yes.
We'll find out.
Here, Matthew, here's this. If Supergirl comes out and she has a male love interest who says, oh, you're too dangerous for me. And then Supergirl says, I have to protect you. It's so important that I protect you. And I'm not going to tell you all of my feelings and what I'm doing because I have to protect you. Then I'll eat my words, but I guarantee you it won't happen.
That's true. There will be no Iris character on the Supergirl TV show. That's for sure.
Yeah, because they don't see Supergirl as needing to protect her boyfriend.
Of course.
Do they? No, I would doubt it. But you know,
well, Supergirl probably does.
All of our male superheroes have to protect their female love interests, and I just really like it.
Ask Spider-Man how that works out for him.
Matthew
on another tangent. We're going to be here for another 20 minutes.
I don't think that's disrespectful to the woman. I don't think it's being any of those things. You know, I think there is a note of chivalry in there, and that shouldn't be dead. And women should feel respected for being like, I care about you. I don't want you dead. We've already seen in this show that Karen has that decision laid in front of her. Everybody in her life is known by these people, and what will happen to them if, you know, she isn't forced to basically kill them to protect them all. This is again, it's why the superheroes do this. They don't want to be forced to be in a position to have to go beyond their own morality, which is they don't usually want to be the person who has to kill somebody to protect their secret. And so I can completely understand why that happens. And again, it's why I like you know, we're going to get there. We're going to get there with Flash. I think that Iris will know by the end of the season.
Kill her off.
I want Iris to fall into the ocean.
Kill her off. She's useless. She's the worst character ever.
It's not going to happen because she is the love interest.
Her and Laurel can go off, you know, and so. They can get...
No, but see, Laurel, they've done better with Laurel.
Oh, stop
now
it.
She's
no,
not,
they haven't. No, she's still
yes,
a...
they have. Now that she's not the obligatory love interest that they keep trying to shove down our throats, she's actually a lot more interesting. And I took me a long time, 2 seasons to be precise, but I'm finally on board with Laurel being on the show.
She's a pale imitation of her sister, and we all know it.
Well, guys, I'm going to say it has been fun talking about Daredevil and all of the other things here. But as you can tell, we are having a blast on the 602 Club, just getting to talk about all these geeky things. And I just have to say, there are a plethora. I mean, it's like pure geek joy these days. All of this. Can you imagine that we're getting all this stuff? We're getting Daredevil. We're getting Superman going against Batman. We're getting new Star Wars. I mean, who would have thought? And it's just fantastic that we have years and years of enjoyable things to talk about because of what's happening. And that's what's really exciting for me. And I hope that you guys just enjoy our conversations. We have a blast doing it together. And we have a passion for it. We just enjoy talking about it, whether we're disagreeing or not. I think even here when we disagreed, we did it very respectfully. And that's what we want to do, is we want to bring you that passionate conversation, the joy that we have for things, and have conversation that leads to disagreement, but leave the bar friends. And that's what we do here at the 602.
Wouldn't it be boring if we always agreed?
It really would.
Yeah,
we could just go around in a circle ever. And be like, yes, Matthew,
that
I agree.
Is great. That's great. Let's move on to the next part. Oh, that's good, too.
Yeah.
Right. You thought that was awesome? I thought that
you
was awesome.
That? Yeah. Well, here is a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
It's not an overstatement, and you had said in your introduction that without him and his hand guiding all of this, then it's unlikely that 2 would have been what it was, and if it had not been successful, then it probably would have meant the end of Star Trek at that point.
Earl Grey.
Like, I'm expecting Ricardo Martaban to, like, walk around the corner and be like, Captain Picard, welcome.
This is Risa 5!
The shuttlecraft. The orb.
Curzon is involved with the Kittimer Accords. Spock is at Kittimer when those are being talked about, so you would think they would have run into each other.
They probably hung out in the bar together.
To the journey! One guy's like, why don't we just write better stories for Wesley? And then the lead writer's like, you out now! The Ready Room.
The movie series would not have relaunched and become what it was if not for the amazing bounce of The Wrath of Khan. The Wrath of Khan was to Star Trek the same thing that The Best of Both Worlds was to Next Generation.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
It's also the end of a character and a thing that is really about how death is just a part of life. And that while there's an end, it doesn't mean that it's the end.
Literary Treks.
Well, I've always liked the... I like that episode for... I mean, it's one of the most derided of the original series episodes, but yet I always, it has a place in my heart for some reason. I've always enjoyed watching it over. So I wanted to do something with those guys, the Scalbians.
The 602 Club. Like, I could kind of dismiss Droids in Distress and Fight or Flight and everything like that, and I just kind of watched in the background, but all of a sudden I started catching myself, like, stopping working and just focusing on watching. And so it just got better and better and better. And I think I was hooked by episode 4, Breaking Ranks. That's when I was like, okay, I like this show. This is good. Warp 5.
In the history of Axanar, Alec Peters and Christian Gossett wrote a section of the history dealing with the Arcanus campaign. And in the Arcanus campaign, a majority of Starfleet ships were destroyed.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Guys, check out these shows and find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, do us a quick favor and hit that subscribe button. It really helps us out greatly. If you do enjoy the show, you enjoy our conversations, one of the best ways to help us out with that and sharing it with others is that subscribe button. It helps us rise in those iTunes rankings, as do the star ratings and reviews. I love hearing your passion for this show and the things that we talk about through those star ratings and reviews. Some of the people have actually just found the show through our conversations, like Man of Steel, where they said they enjoyed the conversation. They loved that we had respectful disagreements. Daniel, you were on that show. We still came away friends. I still have you back to the 602.
Here I am.
Because it makes for great conversation. Absolutely. If you're not an Apple user, you can get our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can stream and download the MP3 files from our website. Grab that RSS link as well. Another way that you can help keep all of our shows coming to each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. We are a listener-supported network, and we have a real passion for bringing you the best Star Trek podcasts and beyond. And we love getting to share that with you, but we need your help to do that. And you can go to patreon.com/trekfm and you'll find all the goals and milestone contribution levels we have there. We really appreciate your support. Thank you to all of you who have joined us. And again, you'll find all the details on patreon.com/trekfm. I want to say a special thanks to my associate producers, Norman Lau, for his support of the network and the 602. He's been with me from the very start here. His Twitter account is at Norman Lau. He's a big supporter of the Star Trek Axanar Project. It can be found on the official Facebook page as well as the Babel Conference. And last but not least, he's a big supporter of the network on Patreon, and he is the host of Warp 5. And of course, Ken Tripp, I want to thank him for his support and being an associate producer here on the 602. If you'd like to contact us, that would be fantastic. We'd love to have some contact from you, whether it's on the website at trek.fm/contact, Twitter at trekfm, Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm, and of course, there's the Babel Conference, which is our listeners-only discussion group. If you enjoy all the conversation we have here like in the 602 or on any other shows, you can join us in the Babel Conference. Just type the Babel Conference in the search field on Facebook or go to the website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar. Now, guys, thank you so much for being on the show today. Andy, tell everybody where they can find you online.
Well, you can watch my live tweeting of my first time watching Star Trek at First Time Trek. I just finished The Wrath of Khan, which was excellent, and I cried a lot. You can also...
As you should.
Yeah. I mean, I'm pretty sure the last 15 minutes was just me brokenly sobbing, so there's that. And then I also have my archive project on Tumblr, firsttimetrek.tumblr.com. And I'm also on the podcast Women at Warp, in which four women talk about Star Trek.
And Daniel, where can we find you online?
They can find me here on the network, on Trek FM, on Earl Grey with my co-hosts Darren and Philip, where we talk TNG all the time. It's fantastic, and you can take a listen. And they can also find me on Twitter, and my handle is 1UpDan. That's the number one, not the word.
Well, guys, of course, you can find me on Twitter at MattRushing02. You can also find me doing The Orb with Christopher Jones, where we talk exclusively about Deep Space Nine all the time. You can also find me doing Literary Treks, where we talk about the books and the comics of Star Trek. And I also have my own personal blog at 42lifeinbetween.wordpress.com. Well, thank you so much for joining us, and y'all come back now. You hear?